This week on Snark Squad Pod, we're joined by Caitlin Voss to talk about The Knife of Never Letting Go by Patrick Ness. Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. I'm Nicole Sweeney.
My name is Marines, and this week we are joined by Caitlin.
Hi, I'm Caitlin. I have a podcast called That's Not How Science Works, where I talk about the bad science in television and movies, and I'm also on Twitter.
We've asked Caitlin to join us this week to talk about The Knife of Never Letting Go. I will front load this with the fact that this is one of my favorite books, and I know it is also a very divisive one, so I'm super excited to talk about it. But first, it is my job to give you a plot synopsis. Here we go. We start in a small settlement on a planet called New World, and it is an alien planet recently colonized. And as far as we know, this is the only settlement that has survived. And we follow the last boy in the settlement, and his name is Todd Hewitt. We know that his birthday is fast approaching, in which he will go from being a boy to being a man. But right before this happens, his adoptive fathers pull him aside and basically tell him that he needs to get the heck out of town. He needs to run. And everything that he grew up knowing was false. So they give him a book that belonged to his mother. They try to prepare him as much as they can, but they end up getting caught sort of at the last minute. So Todd doesn't get equipped with as much knowledge as he needs, but he just needs to run along with his dog. As he tries to make it out of the town, he heads towards the swamps and finds there a girl that has crash landed from another ship. And this rocks his world because as far as he knew, there were no women on the planet at all. And he's never seen a woman at all, except for this very important thing that I forgot to tell you. On this planet, all of men's noises can be heard. So all of men, like their thoughts, you can hear them outside of their heads. So everyone knows what everyone else is thinking. And when these settlers landed on the planet, they found that the men's noises could be heard, but the women not so much. And at first they thought that this was a germ warfare because of the aliens that were native to this planet, the Spackle. So Todd finds this girl. He realizes that everything he knows is kind of false. Again, this is a recurring theme. He keeps getting faced with this thing that everyone ever told him was false. So they are being chased first by the holy man back of their town, Prentice Town. And then later they realize they're being chased pretty much by a whole army from Prentice Town. So Todd and Viola, they team up together to run and run and run. And the middle of this story is like a cycle of like getting away, thinking that they're okay for a second, finding some other new thing to run away from, back and forth, back and forth. And as they run, a few things, very important things happen. So they come across other settlements. They learn that they're going towards Haven, which is where Todd's father's kind of sent him to find some help. Along the way, as they're finding people, losing people, Todd also loses his dog, Manchi, which I know will be a huge sticking point for everyone on this podcast. And
to interject here, it'll be a sticking point because he doesn't lose the dog. The dog is murdered. He watches the dog get murdered. Okay. You can continue
okay, we'll
now.
Get there. The dog gets murdered by Aaron, the holy man, who does eventually again catch up with them. And it's kind of revealed that in Prentice Town, they separated themselves because they first believed that the Spackle needed to be fought and like killed and exterminated. And after that wasn't enough. They also found or thought that the women needed to be killed because of their quiet, because of the fact that they didn't have noise. So the men of Prentice Town were kind of shut off from the rest of the world. Nobody bothered them, but it was with the understanding that if they ever left that settlement, they would be killed, basically executed for their crimes. So the way that boys become men in this town is also by committing a murder, usually another man in the town. And so the cycle of men murdering men continues and everybody in this town remains guilty. So Aaron has been following Viola and Todd this whole way with the purpose of being a sacrifice, sacrificing himself so that Todd will also become a murderer and the last boy of Prentice Town would become a man. They have a showdown and Todd is ready to kill him because he's, you know, attacking them. But at the last minute, Viola steps in and kills Aaron instead. Then as we figure that Aaron is gone, they are like leaving the place again and Viola's shot. And we find out that the army from Prentice Town has caught up with them anyway. And the whole time they were walking into a trap, they never had any hope of making it to Haven, the end, and it ends on a literal cliffhanger. So I know there were a lot of details in the middle that I kind of flew over, but the gist is bad things happen forever, the end.
Yeah, that's this book. Bad things happen forever, the end. You kind of already teased your answer to this question. Not teased, you told us the answer to this question. But I guess actually, because this book was published over a decade ago, and Mari has already told us that it's one of her favorites, my first question is, even before we get to Did You Like This, had you read this book before we asked you to be on this podcast?
Yes. So I read this book when it first went around kind of the YouTube book community in the 2000s sometime in the aughts, maybe. And I did not like it then. And I reread it after you guys asked me about being on this podcast, and I still didn't like it. Although I will say it read a lot differently in this time and in this place and to me as a 30-year-old than it did when I read it like 8 years ago.
That is very interesting. Mari, just so that we can complete the process, did you like this book?
This is my fourth time rereading this book. I first read it in 2012. I rated it 4 stars, and I reread it twice, 2 other times, basically with friends and buddy reads, because I love giving this book to people and saying, tell me what you think, because it is very divisive. So this is my fourth time rereading this first book. I have read the second book. I've never finished the series because I know that it is going to literally wreck me. And so every time I get close to like picking up the third book, I'm like, no, I'm not ready yet. But I think this might be the time that I go through them completely. Anyway, the point is, I really enjoy this book. I think that I can step back and see its faults, but I think that so many of those things that are not necessarily for other people are deeply ingrained to the theme and the narrative style of this book. And I just find it so compelling, so well done. And I like I said, I can't wait to talk to you guys about it. And then every time you tell me you don't like something, tell you why that's wrong.
I have a feeling, I was thinking about this yesterday, actually, when I finished reading it, and the fact that this was your fourth read of this book, that I think in a lot of ways, this will be a little bit like us talking about the His Dark Materials books. Like, there's a level of, you know the material so well that even the things that, you know, maybe aren't great and that maybe on your first read, you could have pointed out as like, this thing isn't that great. But because you've now had all this time to sit and think about it, you can like follow through, like, okay, no, here's why that really works. Like, I know it doesn't work like on this first level, but if you go like 4 levels down, it's a perfect choice because of this and this. So I'm excited to let you have that experience.
Thank you.
I am still torn on how exactly to answer the question of did I like this. I lean yes. In general, I think my answer is yes. I like went to give it a star rating on Goodreads and I didn't really know how. So for me, this is going to be another one of those times where I'm figuring out what my feelings are as we go. So I'm really excited that one of you loves it and one of you doesn't. So this is going to be really good for me to work out my feelings. I think it makes sense to start with Todd and the narrative voice of the book. I think, I don't know, there's a little bit, those are slightly separate things, but I want to start there both because it just seems like a logical place to start, but also my sort of mixed feelings began there. It's a thing that ultimately worked for me by the time we got to the end, but I had a really hard time appreciating Todd Hewitt. Partially, honestly, the initial reason is not at all this book's fault. It's the sort of linguistic style through which we are introduced to Todd Hewitt gave me traumatic flashbacks to The Maze Runner, which is a book that I hated.
I thought you were going to say Huck Finn.
Right. And that makes sense. And the thing that it was reminding me of in The Maze Runner is not a thing that this book was ultimately doing. The Maze Runner, it's a weird problem to solve if you are a writer, that if you are dealing with a setting that clearly like was once our world, but is now certain layers removed, that linguistically things are going to be certain layers removed. And The Maze Runner's way of dealing with this was to have his characters use like, I don't know, he had like a dozen obnoxious, silly, absurd slang words that these super genius kids used all the time. And it was just like, I don't know what you're doing. None of this makes any sense. In the case of Todd Hewitt, the sort of linguistic quirks of this character ultimately made sense to me, but it took me, was hard for me to get into. The other thing about Todd Hewitt is that his like defining trait early on was that he keeps kicking his fucking dog. And that was really upsetting to me, especially so I both read this and listened to it on audiobook, and the like listening to the audiobook narrator say, "Ow, Todd," every time Todd kicks him was just really upsetting. And I hated this kid for like a couple chapters before I finally came around to him. But
how was the audiobook? Because I'm curious, because in a book that's written in like a vernacular, a very heavy like vernacular style, like The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn or whatever that book is called, I have in the past found that the audiobook is easier to get into, mm-hmm. but I've never listened to this one on audio.
The audio is really interesting. I think it's really good. And it's interesting because obviously like the text has the sort of visual representations of the noise. I like the audio's approach to it better, which is that you hear the noise over, you know, you hear like layered, it's layered audio. And I think that seems better to me personally, but it's weird because they Americanized it. So, and it's, yes. There's a part late in the book that like genuinely upset as a runner, and this, these kids are running the entire freaking book. And like late in the book, there's a bit where they went with whatever was the easiest and simplest sort of, conversion. Like they don't actually convert things. So there's a bit where the book says they run 3 to 4 kilometers and the audio says 3 to 4 miles. And it genuinely upset me because those are meaningfully different distances to run. Just so we're clear. But yeah, so they Americanized it. And so part of how they gave, I don't know, Todd has this like heavy sort of twang to the way that he's speaking, which I don't think communicates quite the same thing as mm-hmm. the written text does. But otherwise, I thought it was really well done. The Americanizing was very weird when I was also looking at the actual text. I was like, I don't really know why you're making these choices that you're making. But other than that, it was very good. But anyway, that sort of sidebar. What did you guys think of Todd? How did you find Todd Hewitt?
So when I started reading this book again, the reread, I went back and read my notes. And unfortunately, when I first read it, I only had like partial notes in Goodreads. I like to pretend that nowadays I take better notes in Goodreads, which is a partial lie. But one of the things I distinctly said was, it's a really hard start to the book, but once you get out of Prentice Town, it gets a lot better. And I felt that both times, because I was trying to figure out, this time reading it, I knew where it ended. And so I was like, did I always like it until the end? Or like, where do I feel about it? But I had that same experience this time too, where it's like a shock when you start reading Todd, his like style of narration and the fact that he kicks his dog all the time, which is very upsetting. The fact that he can never admits he needs help. A lot of things about him are very frustrating in the first 2 or 3 chapters. Mm-hmm. But once you actually get going on the journey, it's a lot easier to take that journey with Todd. So I think Todd is really hard to like initially, but I also think that, I don't know if this is how I felt the first time I read it, but definitely on a second read, I don't know if this is too early to bring this up, but I realized rereading this book that it's probably one of the early books that I read that's really dealing with toxic masculinity and its like effect on society. And so I think I had a little more compassion for Todd, but not always. Sometimes I still wanted to shake him.
I think I want to put a pin in that thought in particular. But
yes.
But yes.
So I think that I had the same experience. And I think that Todd is unlikable or difficult. It's difficult to like Todd when you first meet him. And so, but I also think that that's purposeful. And I think that that is the emotion that Ness is trying to give you when you first meet Todd. And, you know, the intent and the enjoyment of the thing are two separate things. So you can know that, you know, Ness was trying to do that and still not enjoy it. But I think the story introduces you to a Todd who who it is not easy to root for. And even when he is with Viola and he's starting to like learn these things, he is incredibly frustrating. And so there are things that are outside of him that you can blame that on. Like he's not educated, right? His lack of education. And that is a thing that is frustrating to himself. Like he doesn't know how to ask for help. He doesn't know how to be vulnerable because of that, like, you know, environment he's grown up with. He's grown up in a place where it has been both an overload of information and incredibly secretive. He doesn't know anything about his life. And so those kinds of things playing on his personality are, I think, are very evident, where he also has all of these external emotions and all of the noise, but he doesn't know how to express anything. He doesn't know how to be open with Viola or with us, you know, as kind of the reader. So I think those are all of his weaknesses that are meant to be his weaknesses. And you see a lot of his growth as a character. And, you know, this is a very clear boy into man coming of age story. Mm-hmm. So I think we're supposed to see a lot of those childish and frustrating and, you know, yes, you want to shake him behaviors from Todd, but at the end of it, I still feel more compassion and empathy for him. You know, even the thing with his dog, you know, nobody wants to read about a kid kicking a dog, but you think about the way that he never even wanted this dog, and like he never gets what he wants. And he's like, the first thing he says, like, I didn't even want this dog and I'm saddled with the responsibility. And in a story that is about, like, you know, he gets it as a birthday present, in a story that is about getting something on your birthday you don't really want. Like, I just thought that that was like a neat parallel. So no, the violence, you know, is not great or whatever, but it's supposed to make you feel not great about Todd so that you really have a starting point for his arc overall.
I do think there's a lot of intentionality in this book.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think it's part of why I have such a hard time assessing how I feel about it, right? Because I can recognize all of the ways in which this story was very deliberately crafted. But like, you know, something being done on purpose doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, like good, or that I want to be reading about it. Because good is we have talked about this a bunch on the podcast, but I think like good, bad, those are sort of meaningless metrics. And is this an experience that I want to be having? I don't know. Since I started with Todd, who I am still, I'm on the fence about Todd. I guess I didn't really say where I landed. I only said about how hard it was to get into him in the first place. I appreciated him a lot more by the end of the story. I came around a lot on Todd. But immediate favorite character. Man, she is the best character in the entire book. I there was something about the introduction of this world, the idea of the noise and having this talking dog, but not this super smart talking dog, which I feel like, you know, in other iterations of, oh, the animals can talk, they're suddenly intellectuals. But this is basically like a talking dog saying all the things that you, like, your dog probably would say if your dog had language. Like my dog would be trying to tell me he has to go poop most of the time, right? There was something about that was incredibly endearing, and like that was my first hook into the story. I was gonna use this just to like talk about how great Manchi is, but I think actually the more interesting thing here is how you found the world building in general.
I actually think that Ness does a really good job of introducing us to the world through Todd, because Todd definitely knows some things about the world, but there's also a lot he doesn't know. So it doesn't feel like, oh, it's your first day and you're gonna learn all the things. But it feels like a good mix of like, these are the unusual things, and they're introduced almost right away. The noise comes up right away. The talking animals come up right away. No women comes up very quickly. All of these things like set the stage. And then because the book is really about all the ways that everything Todd knows is a lie, you as the reader also get to learn things. So I actually really like the world building generally. And I will say, it's interesting that you love Manchi, because I think when I first read it, I also really loved Manchi. And this time, I liked Manchi, but that, I don't know if he was my favorite character. I'm not sure if you guys
Everyone's welcome to their wrong opinions, Caitlin.
But I'm pretty sure I've read a tweet from Patrick Ness at some point saying that he gets more like angry messages about Manchi's death than like anything else he's ever written. Which is deserved.
I in the middle of reading, like, I stopped reading to yell at Marty on Discord. So I get it.
I really enjoy the world building here. I think that this idea of like all of your innermost thoughts being out for public consumption is just really compelling. And I think that, like, as a vehicle for letting Ness explore, you know, whatever it is that he's saying about the thoughts of men and about lies and secrets and growing up, and then, like, pairing that up with the silence of women on this planet and the thoughts of animals, even what he has, like, different animals say, like the here horde or whatnot. And then I think the crickets just say, like, sex, sex over and over. and the birds are asking for safety. Where's safe, basically? And I found all of those details, like, really rich and interesting. And I think that he weaves, I don't know if this is, like, fourth read and in 2019, like, seeping in here, but he weaves so many things that feel like things that are happening or that could happen, so that when you get, like, the really out there, like, sci-fi things, like The Noise, they feel more grounded. And I don't know. So something about, like, that play of, like, yeah, it talks toxic masculinity. I get it. And also, like, Noise Germ. That's cool because it's grounded in something that I can, like, put hooks into. And I think that's where Manchi is, like, really cool as an anchor in this world, because, you know, dogs, we've seen them, you know, you kind of seen a yappy, you know, a yappy dog. And that whole idea of, like, yeah, a dog would be saying poo or your name just over again, like Todd, Todd, Todd. Yeah, like, that's a dog, you know? Right. So grounding that, and even if it's giving it a sci-fi twist, I thought was really neat. Todd and Viola are my favorite characters. Manchi's great. But yeah, Todd and Viola.
Yeah. Even the way that Ness, because it's a set, like a settlement. There we go. There's a settlement on this planet of people who were kind of, like, agrarian and not necessarily, like, these big scientists. They are able to have a very, like, kind of simple society that I think he's able to do more with, but he's also able to introduce through Viola, who is part of this, like, new settler colony that's going to be there in 7 months. Through her, he's able to have advanced tech, so he can bring in, like, magical healing and other things. Like, I think it's a good balance.
Yeah, the way that we are introduced to the world in general is very strong. I think I have a lot of problems with the withholding of information and how all of that worked. And that's, I don't know, that affected some of my feelings about the world building later on. Like, there are some plot things that were, like, it doesn't all mesh, but the world itself, like, focusing just on the way that, you know, we are introduced to this world, I thought was really, really strong. And once I got over my initial, like, talk problems, I was in this world really strongly. And I will say that, you know, because I had my, like, oh God, the Maze Runner sort of knee-jerk reaction, the other thing that once I was, you know, appreciating the story for what it actually was, instead of being afraid of it being something that it wasn't, I appreciated the way in which we were introduced to new vocabulary strictly as it was useful. Like, we weren't given a bunch of sort of nonsense words just to say, like, look, this is a new and different place. Like, we know it's a new and different place because of all of these other things that are happening here. And all of the new vocabulary that we were given, I mean, some of it is just, you know, noise is obviously a word that already exists, but, like, capital N noise of the book is a, you know, new word for this setting. And we were given that word directly tied to, like, yes, you need to know this. This is relevant, which I also very much appreciated. There was no, the world building didn't waste my time, I guess is really, really what I'm getting at, which is another sort of frequent problem of mine. All of the world building was very effective and efficient.
I often found myself forgetting that it was technically on, like, a sci-fi alien planet setting, because I'd, like, halfway through the book, I was like, wait a minute, like, I'm assuming all of these animals that are using the terms that I know look like the animals we know. But honestly, there could be just a furry thing that looked just enough like a dog that the settlers decided to call it a dog. Mm-hmm. It actually made me think, I don't know, I think this book has been optioned as a potential movie.
Yes.
Which I don't know how they're going to film it, but it did make me wonder.
So excited.
Yeah, if they're going to choose to go, like, very sci-fi or not in it. There's so many things that work on the page because your brain fills them in. And then as you learn, they're actually different than you substitute. That would be hard to visually represent.
So I don't know, I'm taking over right now. I want to bring this back around to Manji and Manji's death. And I know we were going to get there eventually, but it is obviously supposed to be a heartbreaking thing. And so I totally get like the feelings there and whatnot, but I always find it really, really interesting that people find this moment as like the, that's it, I hate Patrick-ness or whatever it is, because this world is like so violent. Like we learn like all the women are killed in this settlement. And, you know, Todd is being beat up throughout all of this. Like there's so much violence in it that the fact that like this is the one that people are like, oh, that's it. You know, I was okay with the alien warfare and with the killing of all the women, but like the dog, and that's the line I'm going to draw, is always super interesting to me. But I think that's because I never really had a dog and I'm not a dog person. I don't know if that's it. Like, I don't know. I'm just always like, but did you like read the rest? It's all pretty violent and gruesome.
I mean, I think part of it is the, like, Manji's death is sort of a moment of, like, nah, this shit's for real hopeless. So there's that piece of it, right? Like, I don't know, because you're with them. You're with them and thinking, like, they just got to get to Haven and they're going to get to Haven. And honestly, even after Manji's death, there is still, like, no, like, they're going to get to Haven and then, like, that's how we're going to get to the, you know, happy ending of the thing. I feel like I knew at some point that this was part of a series, but I completely forgot. And so when we got to the fact that it wasn't all okay at the end, I was particularly upset about that too, just because I was expecting that we were going to get to the end and then that was going to be the end of a story instead of a cliffhanger for the new thing. But to this point about Manji, I think, so part of it is that, part of it is the degree to which that was solidifying the sense that like, this is in fact all completely hopeless. I also think that in general, like some of this is broader cultural, like this comes up a lot. And like, this isn't just about this book. This is often in media, people say this all the time about Game of Thrones, that like when they kill Lady, like that's the thing that is the unforgivable moment of the show. And I think part of it is just that like animals are helpless. Like it's like they're helpless characters, right? So you're watching human beings choose to inflict all this brutality on one another, whereas the animals are like,
didn't sign up for this.
Right. Didn't sign up for this. And so I think that is part of what's going on there. I mean, like, to be clear, to me, this is not the thing that I'm like, oh, fuck this whole book.
No.
Because, you know, Manji the dog died. That is, but there is also, I think, a more intense and like visceral reaction to that. Just because there's like a separate sort of category in which viewing animals in media. I don't know.
Yes, I agree. I think there is like definitely like a bias towards animals and particularly dogs. But also Manji is a huge part of Todd's character development.
Yes.
And he's basically the first thing we see Todd interact with that he starts to trust that he didn't previously. I think Todd really starts to love Manji before he even sort of loves Viola. And at the end, when he's so helpless and he just looks at Todd and he doesn't understand why Todd is leaving, that is very like heart crushing. But this was interesting to me too, because in my mind, when I remembered this book, I thought that Manji's death happened much later. I thought that Manji's death and the very end of the book, which is the thing that I hate, happened very close together. I thought it was like a 1-2 punch. So when I got to it and I still had like, I don't know, 70 pages left, I was like, did Manji actually die? And now this read, I don't think this was true the first time, but on this read, I thought the Spackle's death was just as upsetting to me personally as Manji's death.
Yes. So the Spackle's death was, Manji's death is upsetting to me in a very in-story kind of way. The Spackle's death, that to me is like a point that I have very mixed and complicated feelings about in terms of what the Spackle's death signifies in Todd's journey. Like Manji's death serves a very clear purpose in the story. And like, I get that purpose. And all of that, I mean, it is emotionally devastating, but yes. I don't actually have qualms with it, you know, from the perspective of like, this was a bad choice as Patrick Ness shouldn't have done this thing. The Speckle's death, I have complicated feelings about because of where it sits in this discussion of like who Todd is going to be and all these questions that Todd is asking himself about who he's going to be. The Speckle's death felt more like a betrayal of the story in a way that Manchi's death didn't. I don't know. That's not an opinion that I feel married to be clear. Like, I'm prepared. I know Mari's like getting ready. But I, at the moment that it hits, that was another one of those things that I was like, oh God, like this has to just be like a dream or, you know, whatever, like this can't really be happening. But because yes, I agree that it was incredibly devastating, but it was also devastating in this way, that it made me feel a pointlessness almost to Todd's journey, to this journey for Todd to like not become a killer, that I don't know, that he like he's just going to anyway, for all of the, because it, he was taught to be that way, and that like he can't escape the fact that he was taught to be that way. I don't know, it just it unsettled me. Narratively unsettled me.
I think it's very interesting because I didn't remember the Spackle's death, so when it happened I was like shocked. But for me, it seemed like a narrative way to put the brakes on some of what Todd had been taught. So this doesn't happen in the book, but my assumption is that Todd, he has certainly seen death before of livestock, and I would be surprised if he hadn't actively like killed a sheep before.
Right.
Maybe he hasn't. It seems very weird to me that he hasn't. But I think that Prentisstown makes a big distinction between killing people and killing livestock, obviously. I think that fact that, and he talks about hunting, so he's definitely killed like squirrels and turtles.
Right.
I think the fact that Todd is as affected by the Spackle's death as he would be by another human, but the Prentisstown humans wouldn't see it that way, allows Ness to kind of put the brakes on Todd's bloodlust without having him actually kill a human. If that makes sense. That's how it read to me. Now I'd like to hear expert.
I was thinking about how you earlier described this as a very deliberate story. And it strikes me now, like talking through this, this is part of the reason that I love it, is because it has like all of these layers and it does feel very deliberate, and because it opens itself up well to rereading. And it honestly is reminding me a lot of like talking to Nicole about his Dark Materials and the ways that you would like think forward and be like, but wait, this is like the first part of this like series that we're reading. So There's a longer story that we're telling here versus what's contained in this one book, which is difficult to tell somebody who hasn't read the whole thing, because this book should be one contained story, but also, I don't know, other stuff happens.
Right.
So I think that for one thing, Manchi's death, I think, signifies like the entire journey to me is kind of this idea of like tackling what it will be for Todd to go from boy to man, and this idea that that is tied in a loss of innocence, and then very deeply associated for Todd in like this like tradition of killing and whatnot because of where he grew up. And so throughout the whole thing, even when we come across Farbranch and Hildy, they're calling Todd pup, right? He's the pup. Mm-hmm. And so the actual death of the pup along the journey, I thought just, it was another thing. Yeah, the pup. It was a very like deliberate, like you see almost like the shedding of innocence through this journey. And I think it's a complicated thing that Ness is trying to get at. Like, is growing up necessarily a loss of innocence? And in a lot of ways it is. And so towing that line between Todd maintaining essential Toddism versus the violence and the brutality of the world that he's grown up with is something that I think you see like coming to a head over and over again in a very cyclical way during this journey. And I think that the Spackle is that as well. You know, it was even more, not even more, it was equally as heartbreaking for me to watch that moment, just because in the series as we continue, and I think a big theme of what, you know, Todd is, or Ness is getting at here, is that whatever Todd has to unlearn, it's going to take a lot. It's not the journey of a single book. It's not just, oh, a spackle. Okay, cool. I guess they're fine. You know, he's been almost indoctrinated in a certain way.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely indoctrinated.
And that's not an easy thing for him to overcome. And it's certainly not going to happen the first time he sees a spackle. And the spackle become like a bigger thing. And he has to encounter a lot more of them in the next book. So this is something that he's laying the groundwork for. And I think a big theme of the book is that the things that are unknown to you are scary, and the violence that people justify against things that are unknown because they don't know them. And even though Todd is our hero, he still has to encounter that. So I don't know. That's why I'm okay. Not okay. It's still a bad thing. But in the story, I'm like, I see where this is going.
Can you remember back to when you were first reading it? This, I can't. So it's okay if you can't. But can you remember back to when you were first reading it, if you had in mind, like, there must be a bigger plan to this? Or not so much?
Not at all. I mean, I knew it was part of a series. I don't think that I expected the cliffhanger quite how it happened. And I think that even as you get hit with the punches of like the spackle and Manchi, you have that whole extended like sequence of Ben being like, you gotta have hope. So I was like, okay.
Right. I gotta have hope. The book's fucking telling me to have hope.
Yeah. And then that's all like torn to shreds. So I went through the very like up and down emotional like reaction the first time I read it, for sure. But I think that rereadings, even then, I rated it kind of higher than average just because I felt like you read this and I like knew the writing was good. I knew that some of these things here, I wasn't sure if all the pieces were exactly for me. And in reading, I'm like, yes, this is great. But I did very much have that same like reaction of what, I don't know, the ups and downs of like kind of this hopeless cycle or whatnot.
Okay. So I want to move through then. I feel like this wasn't what I set out to do, but I feel like what we've essentially done is sort of moved through, okay, all of the things that I was not so sure about and like, let's put them forth for Mari to say, okay, explain this one to me. I think the spackle, my sort of ending place on that is that in this book as a self-contained unit, I have some problems with it, but I 100% see how that can function as part of building a larger sort of story. And the fact that I didn't realize until I got to the end of the story that we were telling a larger story, I think also is important in understanding my particular very specific reading of this book. But the biggest problem that I actually had with this story is the way in which information was withheld. And like, I got to the end and there were things about it that still didn't make sense to me. Like there are layers of the big secret and that information being kept from Todd that never really made sense to me. I still don't really understand the necessity of keeping the secret from Todd. I also don't understand if like part of the whole argument kept being that, oh, he's innocent, search his noise, like he knows nothing. But then Ben tells him anyway before he goes off to Haven. And so I'm like, well, then he does know. I don't know. This is, some of this is definitely like a me thing. I have a big problem with sort of withholding information for the sake of withholding information. I don't really understand why it was necessary for this story. I understand the premise of Todd finding out that the things he believed were wrong and like that idea in a coming of age story. And like, that I get up to a point, but that particular sort of thing, the degree to which Todd didn't know the story of Prentice Town and everybody in Prentice Town keeping this a secret, even with the, you know, complexities of keeping secrets in this world, I find that doubtful. I have a hard time buying that was a thing in the first place. And I don't really understand why it was necessary. I don't know. It bothers me.
When I finished reading the first time, there were like three big things that I also had like bigger issues with. And the withholding of information was definitely one of them. It is not a thing that I like either. And I think that what happened, I think that Ness had like a pretty good explanation as to why. And this idea that any secret would then immediately become part of Todd's noise. And the way that he was terrible at keeping his noise,
yes,
like in throughout the whole story, like validated that. I think that some of the timeline validates this as well. Like, the plan was for Todd to run away and know nothing and be on his merry way. And that kind of got all messed up when they came for Todd early. And, you know, Killian and Ben ended up having to like make a stand so Todd could get away. So I think that that messed up kind of the plan. And we see then later Ben looking for Todd because things didn't happen exactly the way that they were meant to. So I'm not sure if that's why later he's like, okay, I wasn't going to tell you so you could just go and be innocent. But also like now things have changed. Everything has like the timeline almost sped up. The army is coming. You need to know now kind of thing. I think that Ness overly relied on a good foundation that he had for like keeping with withholding the information, and there was too much forced suspense. And it wasn't even the withholding of information from Todd that bothered me as much as Todd withholding information from us, the reader.
Yes.
There were times that he was like, I won't think about that. I'm not going to say that now. In a story that was otherwise like Todd telling us everything. And that part of the forced suspense, when literally you're running across this world and bad things do not stop happening. Like we did not need that extra layer of like, well, I won't tell you this now. I'll tell you later kind of thing. So that bothered me more than like people not telling Todd a thing, because that was fine. He's a child, secrets, whatever. Todd not telling us what he knew, that bothered me more.
Yes, that is also part of what bothered me. The fact that in addition to like people are not telling Todd things, I don't know. I am still really hung up on the idea that this entire town kept this a secret in their noise for 13 years. I don't know. There are pieces of it there, but it's like that's a big ask. And it unsettled me. And I think because it's paired with all of Todd not telling us things, like this other thing that you're talking about, I think maybe I might have been more inclined to let that go if we weren't also getting Todd withholding information from us, the reader, in that way. Like, I think if we had one of the two, I might have been more inclined to, like, you know, be on board. But just all of the, yes, forced suspense and like forced. And now we're not telling you something, like, wink. No, don't fucking wink at me. Fuck you.
I think one of the big themes of this book is about how we lie to ourselves.
Yeah.
And yes. Todd introduces it right away in the second chapter. He says, men lie and they lie to themselves worst of all. And I think it's very frustrating at times, like when Todd intentionally he can't read, but he doesn't ask Viola to read the map and the very
maddening,
important
maddening.
Right, it's very frustrating, but I think I understand the theme of lying to ourselves in order to survive, lying to ourselves in order to continue to see ourselves in the light we want to. And a lot of the things that are happening in the town, like Todd has almost no education and can't read, because it's easier to maintain lies if people are not educated and can't read.
Yes.
And so I think that Prentice Town is lying to itself. And I think some of the men genuinely believe the lie they've told themselves about the women, either that they had to die or even that they aren't the ones who killed them. Because the lie they tell about the war, they totally believe that as well. And I lie to myself all the time. So maybe it's like easier for me to think this. And I say that in that in order for me to function as a human being,
yes,
I absolutely just choose to believe things that are probably not actually true. Like I choose to believe that the decisions I make are the best decisions I could have made at that time. And I just don't look back and I don't have regrets. Does that mean I don't ever wake up at 2 a.m. like sad about something that happened 5 years ago? No. But generally, I tell myself I can't have regrets. And so generally, I don't.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is that, like, it's the reason that this book is so interesting to me. It's like the, you know, facing the things that I don't necessarily like to read about and encountering here and kind of grudgingly admitting that as far as he could, even though this is not a thing I like Ness does some interesting things. And so setting up the theme of like lying to yourself is like huge. I think that we also see time and time again that Todd himself is like particularly bad at hiding his noise.
Yes.
And I think this becomes like a bigger thing of like who Todd is. And it's part of the reason that people are after him too. I think that people know that Todd is different and that there's something about him that probably won't conform and that he's a little bit more vulnerable or whatever it is about Todd that makes him like really bad at this. So I think that that's part of like the decision making there.
No one in this entire book is as bad at containing or hiding his noise.
Literally no one. And so I think that there is even a possibility that Todd has heard some of this in the town, but it's the idea of like all of this noise. And we even see it as he's like rushing to get from the swamp home just so he won't have to hear anything that is going on, whether that's, and he hears, I think he even hears somebody like lamenting his wife or something along those lines in a bar. And he literally shuts his ears to it and books it because he doesn't want to hear it. It's too much. It's overwhelming for him. So I think there are a lot of ways that Ness like lays out why Todd in particular would have been, he would not have gotten this information. But again, if stories where withholding information is not your jam, this is very much that. So,
right. Yes. I definitely like agree with everything you guys are saying. Like, I think that it fits the themes of the story very, very well. It made for like a really frustrating experience.
I mentioned that when I first finished reading it, that there were like three major things that I didn't enjoy. One was like the forced suspense, and two were the villains. And so the two major villains here are Aaron as the holy man and the mayor of Princetown, who is majorly absent from the story, but is a big presence because we keep hearing him like called back to. And at the end, he's who Todd and Viola eventually like meet at the end of the road. So we know that on truly this was the most hopeless journey ever. I will say that since continuing on in the series, the mayor has become one of my favorite villains of all time, ever, ever, ever. Aaron is still questionable. However, reading about Aaron in 2019 was a wholly different experience for me this time. And I am not as upset at, like, I don't know, people are evil sometimes, themes that crop up in this story.
I suspected that this would be the case, what you just said. That so my biggest problem with this book when I first read it was the ending and the villains, and how I feel like Todd and Viola and Manchi even are incredibly well developed, and the villains are not developed at all, and they feel very two-dimensional. My like guess was that the answer is there's two more books to develop the villains. The other reason I dislike this book is I just think it's a terrible like slog to read. And so I'm not going to put myself through that for two more books just to figure out why the villains are not two-dimensional. But yeah.
So I had the experience of reading it for the first time now in 2019, where yes, sometimes people are just evil. But I will say even in 2019, I want to push back on that a tiny bit because even as I like, yes, I can watch the news in 2019 and sometimes people appear to just be evil. I also, I don't know, like in a story that is so deliberate, like I can still find that unsatisfying. Even if I can also find it plausible and realistic, that doesn't mean it's satisfying that they're just sort of evil for the sake of it. Aaron in particular, the mayor we don't get enough of. To me, I don't know. I honestly don't know why the mayor is evil. We know basically nothing. We only see him for the first time for real at the end of the book. So I have no idea why the mayor is doing the things that he's doing. Seems power hungry. I don't know, whatever. That didn't really bother me. Aaron's whole jam was a little bit like, felt a little nonsensical to me. Felt a little bit like, nonsensical isn't fair. Aaron felt like too much. Not nonsensical, but he definitely felt like a little bit too much and a little bit like, I don't know why you're doing this. But also, yeah, we're reading it in 2019. So I don't know. And this story is very much about toxic masculinity, which I guess now this is the place where we bring this back up again, where we come back to that.
I do want to say, it's funny because you guys say that like reading this in 2019, it was like, yes, sometimes people are just evil. For me, it almost went the opposite way. Reading it in 2019 with the context of 2019 added nuance to these characters that was not there the first time I read it. So the mayor to me reading it, I don't know, 8 years ago or whatever it was, just seemed like evil for the sake of being evil. The mayor now seems power hungry in a more subtle way. And Aaron seems still like, parody is not the right word. He still seems a little bit like a caricature, but he seems a little bit more like I've seen the way that people's beliefs can blind them to things a little more.
The way that people become radicalized also.
Yes. That's a better way of saying it. The radicalization of people in the world makes it like, wow, Aaron could be more radicalized. He still at the very end comes off, I don't know, not quite okay. Mm-hmm. But I thought that the context of the world we live in now, like, added nuance to these characters that I didn't have before.
I agree with that. So I think that seeing them and their motivations, I think, has a little bit more, I don't know, it feels more grounded for me in this time, in this place, and probably because I'm older and probably because of what we're living mm-hmm. through and all of that. But I think that Aaron's problem to me, because I still think that there is something that is like off there, but it's not necessarily how he's characterized to me. It's more of a plot thing, I think. And if Ness had tightened this plot a little more through the middle and taken away one encounter with Aaron, one time that he right. showed up and was alive again, that would have felt better than the constant, like, he's back, he's back, he's back. I think he did it one too many times. And that is a plot tightening thing versus, like, the way that Aaron is written thing. And I'm not sure that I would have felt that way the first time I read it. The fourth time, here's where I have arrived, folks. So the whole thing with Aaron as a villain, though, is really interesting to me because of that idea of being radicalized. And I think another big theme of not only this book, but moving forward in the series, is that war makes monsters of men is a thing that he repeats often. And the third book is called Monsters of Men. So mm-hmm. it's like a huge thing, this idea of, you know, that people can be radicalized or perverted or changed by this idea of violence. And the whole story of Prentistown is that it started with a war against the Spackle, and then it moved from there against a war against women. And so this idea of, like, being so engrossed in killing and murder and violence and not being able to escape that's what Aaron represented to me in a way that I felt more able to connect with this time. For whatever reasons, but still, I think that he was a little overdone.
I think that is 100% the thing. So I'm thankful for you and your four reads to bring all of your experience to this. Because I think in general, like, most of my problems with it actually come down to, you could have tightened the story up a little bit. And I think several of my issues with it probably would have gone away. You know, it's a 500 page book.
Yep.
You know, you maybe could have tightened it down a little bit. So you eliminate, like, one encounter with Aaron, and every time Todd thinks about something that he doesn't want to think about, basically. But I want to get to, what was your third and final original complaint? So the villains, the withholding of information, and what was the other thing that bothered you on first read?
So my final original complaint with this book was the cliffhanger at the end of book one.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something weird to talk about now because I've read book two. So, like, the cliffhanger is no longer the cliffhanger. And also, you compared this to His Dark Material at the beginning. I brought it up again. And the cliffhanger, I had, like, in my notes to bring this up, because in the cliffhanger, it reminded me so much this time of the cliffhanger at the end of book one of His Dark Materials, in that this story, I felt, wrapped up. His journey to Haven wrapped up. That story is complete. However, it did not end happy, which reminds me a lot of Lyra making it to her father. And hey, guess what? Her friend still died. And that story right. wrapped, but it was not happy. And you don't know what it moves forward. So It reminded me so much of that, like, experience, and probably because we talked about it so recently. So I don't have as many strong negative feelings about the cliffhanger now, by virtue of knowing what happens, but also, I don't know, by virtue of, like, kind of seeing better that this story did wrap up in a way. But right. also, the first time I read it, I was mad. I was real mad.
I was also real mad because, like I said, it wasn't until I got to that point that I was like, oh, there's more. So really caught me off guard. And I was mostly mad about that. Yes, I think it's hard to talk about the way this story ends without acknowledging that it's part of a larger work. By itself, it doesn't feel like it ends in a way that is completing this particular story. But I understand how, especially in light of that comparison, how, like, you know, it is an end of this leg of the larger journey. I just didn't realize we were on a larger journey. And that's on me, not the book.
Have either of you read any other Patrick Ness books?
I have. Patrick Ness is it's strange. His work is like largely a 3 or 4 star realm for me. I think with the exception of 1 or 2 books, but I love his writing. I love his writing so much. And so anytime he publishes anything, I'm like on top of it and I'm reading it. I think I haven't read like his last 1 or so book, but yes, I read a lot of Patrick Ness.
Because I have not figured out yet. I might personally have a problem with Patrick Ness endings. So I've read 3 Patrick Ness books. The first one I read was A Monster Calls, which is very unique and was not initially his idea. He took the idea of an author with permission who passed before they were able to write the book. And he like, I don't know how much of it was already on the page and how much of it wasn't. But because of that, I consider that to sort of be an outlier among his work. So I read that. I really liked it. As far as I remember, cried a lot. It was good. I read this one and I hated the ending. Hated the ending. And I don't know if it was because it was a cliffhanger so much as it was the fact that I can, again, in like terms of like lying to myself a lot, I can get through a lot if I believe that things will be good at the end or that there will be hope. And so for the ending to so decisively be like, hope doesn't exist, peace. I literally remember being like, I don't want to go on this journey with this author. I'm done. And even reading it again, I was like, yeah, definitely still not continuing with this series. Then I read, I think it's called The Rest of Us Just Live Here.
Yes.
Which is a book. It's a self-contained, all-in-one, not a series at all, book that he writes about like the side characters who are normal around like super teens. And that book, I also hated the ending. So that makes me wonder if I'm just never going to like a Patrick Ness ending, because as I'm reading the book, I'm like, I really like a lot of things. And then I get to the last couple chapters and I'm like, well, that just ruined everything for me. So yeah, I don't know if only I seem to have this theme, or if like in the books you read, Mari, if his endings are in any way resemble each other.
Yeah. So it's difficult for me to say because I didn't like the cliffhanger, but I didn't not like it because of like what it said in the story. I didn't like it because I was like, well, I want more kind of thing, you know, like
exactly.
I wanted, like, the story is kind of left open for me. And after investing an amount of time in a book, to get to that and feel like the story is left open, it leaves you dissatisfied as a reader. And I totally get that. And it's part of the reason that series, I think, are so tricky, because you have to tell a contained story but leave it open for like an overarching thing. So I totally get that. But I didn't, the fact that he at the end of the road still fell into the hands of the mayor, and after pushing himself forward and telling himself that he had to have hope to get to his destination and only finding that it was like sad and gloomy there, that did not bother me. I think that there, I don't know, something about this story was all about Todd trying to outrun something and then finding at the very end that he couldn't. And whether that is like a larger commentary on like, again, indoctrination and like facing what he left behind. He couldn't just run away from Prentice Town and everything that happened there. Or whether that's talking about like running away from growing up and having to face. Like, I didn't mind the messaging there. So then to like go forward and talk about other endings of Patrick Ness, I've never noticed hating them, but I can like probably say that they are a little more open-ended. So maybe if that's something you don't like, this would, like, his style would be something that you don't jive with.
Yeah. And I don't even know that for me, it's the open-endedness, but I do think it's a very personal thing where he makes decisions right at the end of his books that I don't agree with. And I'm very stubborn. And I believe myself to at least know better what I like. It is interesting that you brought up kind of this idea of Todd trying to run away and not being able to, because on this read of this book, in a lot of ways, it felt like a giant analogy for the internet.
Yes.
And I don't think it's just Todd that tries to run away from Prentice Town. I think all of New World has, I mean, like, cut off Prentice Town, self-care, whatever, But they haven't done anything to mitigate it or to try to reform it or to try to heal it. They have just been like, we're just going to like pretend that doesn't exist and let it fester on the other side of the swamp. And then it comes back to bite them. It's like the 4chan. It's like the 4chan of this book. Just because you're not paying attention to 4chan doesn't mean they're not doing evil things.
I agree. And I think that a lot of Ness's commentary is very strongly coming from that place of like, I mean, this was 2008 when he wrote it. So forgive him a little bit, but from that place of like, information overload. It's so bad. And that idea of like having too much information, too much noise and what it can do to people. I think that heavily skews towards some sort of, you know, commentary on like society these days and the internet. So, but I love that idea of like how everyone thought if they just cut off Prentice Town and did nothing about it, that it would be fine. And it would just like kill itself when really what it was perpetuating itself, and it finally leaked over. So Todd's whole journey to get away from it and to go to a place literally called Haven and then find that there was no Haven, I was fine with that story.
Yes, Prentice Town as 4chan, whatever, this whole internet analogy, I love it. I think it's definitely a layer to reading this story now. I have sort of mixed feelings because I like Caitlin also, I don't know, the idea that we get to the end of the story and a big message of the end of this book is like, hope was a lie, is a problem for me personally. I think that the fact that there is so much else going on here wins out over that in my feelings. I think the thing about this book, where I'm landing now after this hour-long conversation, is that this was not a book that I enjoyed reading. I'm not sure if I will ever reread it, but I think it's going to live very strongly in my feelings. Like once the active experience of pushing through all of the bleakness of this sort of fades away, and I'm just left with all the big themes and like thoughts, things that this gave me to think about, my net sort of experience of it will be mostly positive. I 100% understand why, Mari, you keep reading this as like group reads and keep pushing this on other people and saying, please talk to me about this. Read this and tell me what you thought, because I think this is definitely a book that invites conversation, regardless of whether your feelings about it are positive or negative. I think it invites strong feelings.
Yeah, it does help to know that you're not like comfort rereading it, because
I think, like, what a wonderful story.
Yeah, because I think for me on reread, my problems around the villains, clearly if I just read further, something more would be given to me. My problems around the ending is very personal to me. I can't assume everyone will have that. But it's still like a terrible reading experience. For me, I think there's two things at work. One, in the year 2019, I've been reading a lot of fluffy and not so fluffy, but comforting romance novels because I just need a break. And two, I think when I am going to sort of rub myself raw emotionally, like I often choose to do it by reading nonfiction. And so there's stuff that I've read in nonfiction that in theory is like much more horrifying because it's a real thing that happened to real people. But like, that's what I choose to spend my emotional energy on. Like a couple years ago, I read Missoula and it was amazing and I push it on everyone. It is not a happy read in any way. But to me, I guess I place more value on those things because they're real experiences than on this analogy. And I think that's probably also personal, where some people find it easier to read fiction.
I think that I fed into this a little bit, but I want to clarify that I don't think that the end of this book, that the message or the theme was that hope is a lie. I think that the message was that even when you are on a hopeless road, you need hope to keep going. Because if you don't embrace the hope that something could be fine and something could be okay, or that you have to keep moving, you will just stop and die. And it feeds into that idea of like, you have to lie to yourself a little bit to survive. And so that idea of like, keep pushing and hope, I think is still valid at the end. Again, I'm going to like bring it back to the story of like Lyra and his dark materials and how dark that is and how full of like violence against kids, but that there is still something comforting in that read, even though it is a very violent and dark story. And the fact that she cannot outrun her destiny and she ends up exactly where we thought she would, and it's sad and horrible, but that doesn't kind of negate the themes that are there and this idea that she's is going to keep fighting, and that we see Todd at the very end still fighting and saying, fix Viola, I'll do whatever you want. Like, he's not rolling over and dying. He's going to keep fighting this battle, even if it did not end where he thought it would and where we thought it would as the reader. So I don't think that hope is a lie is what Patrick Ness is getting at. Personally, I understand why we feel that way at the end of this book, but I think there's something a little bigger there.
On that note that, you know, hope maybe is not a lie, that brings us to the end of this episode of the podcast. Thank you all so much for listening, and thank you to Caitlin for joining us. We would love to hear all of your thoughts on The Knife of Never Letting Go. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on StarkSquad.com, or you can join our community on Patreon, where we've got some bonus content and polls, and you can join our Discord at patreon.com/snarksquad. You can also find us on Twitter at snark_squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
You can find me at My Name is Marines.
And you can find me at Caitlin Vanoss, just my full name.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now, and we will be back in your feed again next week. Bye.
Bye.